their consumer appeal. If consumers have no preference, you would expect about 1 in 3 of those polled to vote for each box. As we've seen, the actual results will rarely be distributed so evenly. Employing the chi-square test, you can determine how likely it is that the winning box received more votes due to consumer preference rather than to chance. Similarly, suppose researchers at a pharmaceutical company perform an experiment in which they test 2 treatments used in preventing acute transplant rejection. They can use a chi-square test to determine whether there is a statistically significant difference between the results. Or suppose that before opening a new outlet, the CFO of a rental car company expects that 25% of the company's customers will request subcompact cars, 50% will want compacts, and 12.5% each will ask for cars in the midsize and other categories. When the data begin to come in, a chi-square test can help the CFO quickly decide whether his assumption was correct or the new site is atypical and the company would do well to alter the mix. Through Galton, Catala's work infused the biological sciences. But Catala also helped spur a revolution in the physical sciences. Both James Clerk Maxwell and Ludwig Boltzmann, 2 of the founders of statistical physics, drew inspiration from Catala's theories. Like Darwin and Dostoevsky, they read of them in Buckle's book. After all, if the chests of 5,738 Scottish soldiers distribute themselves nicely along the curve of the normal distribution, and the average yearly mileage of 200 million drivers can vary by as little as 100 miles from year to year, it doesn't take an Einstein to guess that the 10 septillion or so molecules in a liter of gas might exhibit some interesting regularities. But actually, it did take an Einstein to finally convince the scientific world of the need for that new approach to physics. Albert Einstein did it in 1905, the same year in which he published his first work on relativity. And though hardly known in popular culture, Einstein's 1905 paper on statistical physics proved equally revolutionary. In the scientific literature, in fact, it will become his most cited work. Einstein's 1905 work on statistical physics was aimed at explaining a phenomenon called Brownian motion. The process was named for Robert Brown, botanist, world expert in microscopy, and the person credited with writing the first clear description of the cell nucleus. Brown's goal in life, pursued with relentless energy, was to discover through his observations the source of the life force, a mysterious influence believed in his day to endow something with the property of being alive. In that quest, Brown was doomed to failure. But one day in June 1827, he thought he had succeeded. Peering through his lens, Brown noted that the granules inside the pollen grains he was observing seemed to be moving. Though a source of life, pollen is not itself a living being. Yet as long as Brown stared, the movement never ceased, as if the granules possessed some mysterious energy. This was not intentioned movement. It seemed, in fact, to be completely random. With great excitement, Brown concluded at first that he had bagged his quarry. For what could this energy be but the energy that powers life itself? In a string of experiments he performed assiduously over the next month, Brown observed the same kind of movement when suspending in water, and sometimes in gin, as wide a variety of organic particles as he could get his hands on. Decomposing fibers of veal, spider's web blackened with London soot, even his own mucus. Then, in a death blow to his wishful interpretation of the discovery, Brown also observed the motion when looking at inorganic particles of asbestos, copper, bismuth, antimony, and manganese. He knew then that the movement he was observing was unrelated to the issue of life. The true cause of Brownian motion would prove to be the same force that compelled the regularities in human behavior that Catala had noted, not a physical force, but an apparent force arising from the patterns of randomness. Unfortunately, Brown did not live to see this explanation of the phenomenon he observed. The groundwork for the understanding of Brownian motion was laid in the decades that followed Brown's work, by Boltzmann, Maxwell, and others. Inspired by Ketteler, they created the new field of statistical physics, employing the mathematical edifice of probability and statistics to explain how the properties of fluids arise from the movement of the then hypothetical atoms that make them up. Their ideas did not catch on for several more decades, however. Some scientists had mathematical issues with the theory. Others objected because at the time no one had ever seen an atom, and no one believed anyone ever would. But most physicists are practical. And so the most important roadblock to acceptance was that although the theory reproduced some laws that were known, it made few new predictions. And so matters stood until 1905, when long after Maxwell was dead, and shortly before a despondent Boltzmann would commit suicide, Einstein employed the nascent theory to explain in great numerical detail the precise mechanism of Brownian motion. The necessity of a statistical approach to physics would never again be in doubt. And the idea that matter is made of atoms and molecules would prove to be the basis of most modern technology and one of the most important ideas in the history of physics. The random motion of molecules in a fluid can be viewed, as we'll note in Chapter 10, as a metaphor for our own paths through life. And so it is worthwhile to take a little time to give Einstein's work a closer look. According to the atomic picture, the fundamental motion of water molecules is chaotic. The molecules fly first this way, then that, moving in a straight line only until deflected by an encounter with one of their sisters. As mentioned in the prologue, this type of path, in which at various points the direction changes randomly, is often called a drunkard's walk, for reasons obvious to anyone who has ever enjoyed a few too many martinis. More sober mathematicians and scientists sometimes call it a random walk. If particles that float in a liquid are, as atomic theory predicts, constantly and randomly bombarded by the molecules of the liquid, one might expect them to jiggle this way and that owing to the collisions. But there are two problems with that picture of Brownian motion. First, the molecules are far too light to budge the visible floating particles. Second, molecular collisions occur far more frequently than the observed jiggles. Part of Einstein's genius was to realize that those two problems cancel each other out. Though the collisions occur very frequently, because the molecules are so light, those frequent isolated collisions have no visible effect. It is only when pure luck occasionally leads to a lopsided preponderance of hits from some particular direction, the molecular analog of Roger Maris's record year in baseball, that a noticeable jiggle occurs. When Einstein did the math, he found that despite the chaos on the microscopic level, there was a predictable relationship between factors such as the size, number, and speed of the molecules and the observable frequency and magnitude of the jiggling. Einstein had, for the first time, connected new and measurable consequences to statistical physics. That might sound like a largely technical achievement, but on the contrary, it represented the triumph of a great principle, that much of the order we perceive in nature belies an invisible underlying disorder, and hence can be understood only through the rules of randomness. As Einstein wrote, "It is a magnificent feeling to recognize the unity of a complex phenomena which appear to be things quite apart from the direct visible truth." In Einstein's mathematical analysis, the normal distribution again played a central role, reaching a new place of glory in the history of science. The drunkard's walk, too, became established as one of the most fundamental, and soon one of the most studied, processes in nature. For as scientists in all fields began to accept the statistical approach as legitimate, They recognized the thumbprints of the drunkard's walk in virtually all areas of study. In the foraging of mosquitoes through cleared African jungle, in the chemistry of nylon, in the formation of plastics, in the motion of free quantum particles, in the movement of stock prices, in the evolution of intelligence over eons of time. We'll explain the effects of randomness on our own paths through life in Chapter 10. But as we're about to see, though in random variation there are orderly patterns, patterns are not always meaningful. And as important as it is to recognize the meaning when it is there, it is equally important not to extract meaning when it is not there. Avoiding the illusion of meaning in random patterns is a difficult task. It is the subject of the following chapter. Chapter 9, Illusions of Patterns and Patterns of Illusion. In 1848, two teenage girls, Margaret and Kate Fox, heard unexplained noises, like knocking or the moving of furniture. Their house, it happened, had a reputation for being haunted. As the story goes, Kate challenged the source of the noises to repeat the snap of her fingers and to rap out her age. It rose to both challenges. Over the next few days, with their mother's and some neighbor's assistance, the girls worked out a code with which they could communicate with the rapper. No pun intended. They concluded that the rapping originated with the spirit of a peddler who had been murdered years earlier in the home they now occupied. With that, modern spiritualism, the belief that the dead can communicate with the living, was born. By the early 1850s, a particular type of spiritual contact, called table rapping, and its cousin, table moving and table turning, had become the rage in the United States and Europe. The enterprise consisted of a group of individuals arranging themselves around a table, resting their hands upon it, and waiting. In table rapping, after some time passed, a rap would be heard. In table moving and table turning, after time passed, the table would begin to tilt or move about, sometimes dragging the sitters along with it. One pictures serious bearded men with jackets reaching their mid-thigh, and ardent women in hoop skirts, eyes wide in wonder as their hands followed the table, this way or that. Table moving became so popular that in the summer of 1853, scientists began to look into it. One group of physicians noted that during the silent sitting period, a kind of unconscious consensus seemed to form about the direction in which the table would move. They found that when they diverted the sitter's attention so that a common expectation could not form, the table did not move. In another trial, they managed to create a condition in which half the sitters expected the table to move to the left and half expected it to move to the right. And again, it did not move. They concluded that the motion was due to muscular action, mostly exercised unconsciously. But the definitive investigation was performed by the physicist Michael Faraday, one of the founders of electromagnetic theory, inventor of the electric motor, and one of the greatest experimental scientists in history. Faraday first discovered that the phenomenon would occur even with just one subject sitting at the table. Then, enrolling subjects who were both very honorable and accomplished table movers, he conducted a series of ingenious and intricate experiments, proving that the movement of the sitter's hands preceded that of the table. Further, he designed an indicator that alerted the subjects in real time whenever that was occurring. He found that as soon as the indicator was placed before the most earnest subject, the power of the illusion is gone. And this only because the parties are made conscious of what they are really doing. Faraday concluded, as the doctor said, that the sitters were unconsciously pulling and pushing the table. The movement probably began as random fidgeting. Then at some point the sitters perceived, in the randomness, a pattern. That pattern precipitated a self-fulfilling expectation as the subject's hands followed the imagined leadership of the table. The value of his indicator, Faraday wrote, was thus the corrective power it possessed over the mind of the table-turner. Human perception, Faraday recognized, is not a direct consequence of reality, but rather an act of imagination. Perception requires imagination because the data people encounter in their lives are never complete and always equivocal. For example, most people consider that the greatest evidence of an event one can obtain is to see it with their own eyes, and in a court of law, little is held in more esteem than eyewitness testimony. Yet, if you ask to display for a court a video of the same quality as the unprocessed data captured on the retina of a human eye, the judge might wonder what you were trying to put over. For one thing, the view will have a blind spot where the optic nerve attaches to the retina. Moreover, the only part of our field of vision with good resolution is a narrow area of about 1 degree of visual angle around the retina's center, an area the width of our thumb as it looks when held at arm's length. Outside that region, resolution drops off sharply. To compensate, we constantly move our eyes to bring the sharper region to bear on different portions of the scene we wish to observe. And so the pattern of raw data sent to the brain is a shaky, badly pixelated picture with a hole in it. Fortunately, the brain processes the data, combining the input from both eyes, filling in gaps on the assumption that the visual properties of neighboring locations are similar and interpolating. The result, at least until age, injury, disease, or an excess of Mai Tais takes its toll, is a happy human being suffering from the compelling illusion that his or her vision is sharp and clear. We also use our imagination and take shortcuts to fill gaps in patterns of non-visual data. As with visual input, we draw conclusions and make judgments based on uncertain and incomplete information. And we conclude, when we are done analyzing the patterns, that our picture is clear and accurate. But is it? Scientists have moved to protect themselves from identifying false patterns by developing methods of statistical analysis to decide whether a set of observations provides good support for a hypothesis or whether, on the contrary, the apparent support is probably due to chance. For example, when physicists seek to determine whether the data from a supercollider is significant, they don't eyeball their graphs, looking for bumps that rise above the noise. They apply mathematical techniques. One such technique, significance testing, was developed in the 1920s by R.A. Fisher, one of the greatest statisticians of the 20th century. A man also known for his uncontrollable temper, and for a feud with his fellow statistics pioneer Carl Pearson that was so bitter he continued to attack his nemesis long after Pearson's death in 1936. To illustrate Fisher's ideas, suppose that a student in a research study on extrasensory perception predicts the result of some coin tosses. If, in our observations, we find that she is almost always right, we might hypothesize that she is somehow skilled at it, for instance, through psychic powers. On the other hand, if she is right about half the time, the data support the hypothesis that she was just guessing. But what if the data falls somewhere in between, or if there isn't much data? Where do we draw the line between accepting and rejecting the competing hypotheses? This is what significance testing does. It is a formal procedure for calculating the probability of our having observed what we observed if the hypothesis we are testing is true. If the probability is low, we reject the hypothesis. If it is high, we accept it. For example, suppose we are skeptics and hypothesize that the student cannot accurately predict the results of coin tosses. And suppose that in an experimental trial she predicts the coin tosses correctly in a certain number of cases. Then the methods we analyzed in Chapter 4 allow us to calculate the probability that she could have accomplished the predictions by chance alone. If she had guessed the coin toss results correctly so often that, say, the probability of her being that successful by chance alone is only 3%?